Meeting April 15th, and on public hearing on House Bill 2817. Staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2817 requires pharmaceutical manufacturing companies to annually disclose to the Department of Justice certain economic benefits provided in conjunction with the marketing of prescription drug. It also establishes a $10,000 civil penalty for failure to report that information. It specifies exemptions for the disclosure requirement, and it directs the Department of Justice to keep confidential all information reported that qualifies as a trade secret and report other disclosures to the Legislative Assembly and the Governor. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. I think we have a panel signed up. Dr. John Santa, Phil Barnhart first. Thank you, Phil. One of the sponsors of the bill. Sorry, Phil.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Before we begin the hearing, may I make a statement?
Of course.
This is in response to a spamming that members of this committee received over this bill, and I'd like to put on the record my annoyance and aggravation and my sentiment that whoever did this, I hope, is either in the room or listening to the record. I received about 250 identical emails from all over the state on this bill to me, a chief co-sponsor of it. It annoyed me no end. I object to spam in every version, and I think this was a particularly obnoxious version of it. It prevented me from knowing among those 250 emails who my constituents were so I could respond to them on this bill. As were I not a co-sponsor of the bill, if I were neutral on the bill, it would have turned me against it. It would have assured a no vote on this bill. And I want people to understand when they do this, there are consequences. I want to hear from my constituents. I want to hear from other people. But 250 identical long emails to the members of this committee is above and beyond what's acceptable. And I'll be happy to accept an apology for whoever was responsible for it if they're interested in apologizing. But I can tell you as a matter of tactics, it's destructive and useless and counterproductive. And I strongly object to it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did not receive any of those emails, I guess because I'm not on the committee.
Representative Barnhart, I'm going to open the full committee since the full committee is here. So before
thank,
it was just a subcommittee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm a state representative from House District 11, which includes portions of Central Lane and Linn counties. I'm here today to introduce House Bill 2817 and speak in favor of its passage. This bill would require pharmaceutical companies to submit an annual report to the Oregon Department of Justice disclosing all gifts and payments to physicians, hospitals, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals. The bill does not require disclosure of drug samples intended for patients or gifts valued at less than $25. I think it's fair to say, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that consumers are acutely aware of the pharmaceuticals industry's efforts to market prescription drugs directly to patients. How many times do you hear an advertising that starts, quote, ask your doctor about, close quote? What is not so obvious to the public is that marketing directed at our doctors. Last year alone, pharmaceutical companies spent $16 billion in promotions aimed at physicians in America, five times more than they spend on television ads aimed at consumers. Presently, consumers have no way to track this influence, the influence that drug manufacturers bring to bear on physicians. Likewise, healthcare professionals do not have adequate resources to put into context the lobbying efforts of drug companies that they are subject to on a regular basis. This bill would benefit both patients and doctors, providing them with valuable information to support good decision making. This influence over physicians also contributes to the rising cost of prescription drugs in two ways. First, the huge marketing campaign aimed at doctors increases the pharmaceutical costs of producing the drugs. And second, This marketing encourages doctors to prescribe new drugs that are more costly as opposed to better established and less expensive alternatives. This costs both patients and insurance providers more money. And I might say parenthetically also, the state, through the Oregon Health Plan and in other ways that the state supports health care. Colleagues, the U.S. has the highest drug costs in the world, and drug prices increased at an average of 7.1% in 2004. House Bill 2817 is about transparency and accountability. Physicians and their patients deserve to know the extent to which pharmaceutical companies lobby for their products. I want to thank the committee for their consideration of House Bill 2817 and for allowing the public an opportunity to participate in the hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, I think our first panel is Dr. John Santa, Dr. Bruin Ruge, and Dr. Robert Sack.
Bob, you're going to keep us awake, right?
Dr. Satter, would you like to go first?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Santa. I'm a physician. I'm an internist. I practice primary care part-time at the Portland Veterans Affairs, and I work on research, administrative, and teaching projects at Oregon Health and Sciences University, especially the Drug Effectiveness Review Project. This project provides systematic evidence-based reports focusing on comparative effectiveness and safety of prescription drugs. I want to emphasize that my testimony is my own. It doesn't represent the views of the VA, of OHSU, or of any of my colleagues. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2817, and I urge you to convene a work session on this bill. From 2000 to 2003, I served as the administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. During that time, Oregon launched the Practitioner-Managed Prescription Drug Plan, which continues today. I learned from that effort how important transparency and credibility is to healthcare purchasers. That's what I think the issue is today. The approach that Oregon presently pursues to purchase prescription drugs recognizes that a genuine commitment to market forces and competition means the state should use evidence to determine when products are homogeneous and should provide that evidence to purchasers in as transparent a fashion as possible. Basic health economics recognizes that these same two factors are necessary for competition. The bill before you today would start creating a similar environment for individual purchasers of prescription drugs. I suspect that many of you believe that our healthcare system could be improved by market forces, by competition, by more individual responsibility, and by increased individual contributions to the cost of healthcare. I think you're right, but only if you also accept that competitive markets can only happen when buyers and sellers negotiate on a fair playing field. Government is most effective when it sees to it that neither buyers nor sellers become dominant, and that especially is true of being dominant in terms of information. As individuals become more involved in the purchasing process, they will expect government to keep the playing field level. One of the ways to do so is to see that buyers and sellers have access to the same information. Information is not just facts and figures. It's also context, credibility, bias, and reliability, factors that are related to trust. The legislation you're considering today would, in a modest way, let us start, level the information playing field by providing to prescription drug buyers a sense of some of these really important context issues. Let me give you some examples. When drugs have similar effectiveness and safety, it's particularly crucial for consumers to have a context when a physician suggests that they purchase a more or less expensive product. If the evidence suggests these drugs are similar, then cost should become crucial in the purchasing process. If an expert suggests to a purchaser that one drug has an advantage over another, despite the evidence to the contrary, the purchaser deserves to know what the potential biases of the expert are. Let's take an example where drugs are unique. It's very important for a purchaser to know whether those supporting this unique effectiveness argument have anything to gain economically from such a statement. Finally, let's look at a situation where a drug is being prescribed in a context that's not supported by the evidence, or no evidence exists. This is actually a very common situation. Purchasers deserve to know if prescribers have an economic incentive in such a situation, especially if such prescribing is occurring outside of trials. Now, let me emphasize that I believe very strongly that it's not wrong or unethical for physicians to have financial relationships with pharmaceutical companies. And as I thought about my testimony, I recalled many examples in our own state of physicians who've made major contributions to the health of Oregonians and others, and they've received financial consideration in return for the companies they partnered with. This is what the American success story is all about. I'm sure that Albert Starr never hesitated to talk with patients about the success he had in developing the Starr Edwards artificial heart valve. I was fortunate to work with an internist in the 70s, Richard Drake, who most of you probably don't recognize his name. In his garage with his neighbor, Mr. Willock, he developed the Drake-Willock hemodialysis machine, a machine that at one time had 25% of the hemodialysis machine market. He wasn't afraid of telling people about his contribution. We're all aware of the wonderful work that Brian Drucker has done on Gleevec, a drug that has likely saved a lot of lives of people with serious cancers. These are efforts and relationships that physicians should be proud of. When physicians make a substantive contribution to the development or understanding of a prescription drug, their contribution should be acknowledged, not concealed. It strikes me as odd and awkward and concerning that a physician or a company would want to suppress such information. I think most people would share my concern. Why would a physician want to conceal such a contribution unless there really wasn't one? We have very high expectations for our physicians. We expect them to be devoted to an individual patient in the context of a community. That's a complicated task. It's unrealistic to think that physicians will not also have relationships with third parties. If they have an influential relationship with a third party and conceal it, we should not be surprised when both individual patients and communities question their motives. When that third-party relationship is made explicit, patients have an opportunity to decide for themselves. Let's quit underestimating the ability of patients to understand complex relationships and decide for themselves. That's what responsibility really is. People making decisions when they know the facts in context. Trust in physicians and pharmaceutical companies will increase if this bill is passed. Please move this bill to a work session and to the floor for debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Santa. Did he announce his name at the beginning of testimony?
Yeah.
He did? Mm-hmm. Great. And did you say where you presently have your working position, Dr. Mm-hmm. Santa? Great. Thank you very much. Dr. Sack?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this invitation to testify on House Bill 2817. I am currently director of the Sleep Disorders Medicine Program at OHSU. I'm professor of psychiatry and have been with OHSU since 1977, but this testimony is strictly my own personal opinion. It does not represent OHSU.
Dr. Sack, would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Robert Sack, MD. Thank you. My testimony this morning, I'm going to frame it somewhat personally in my experience of being marketed by pharmaceutical companies, and I'm going to quote quite heavily from an article that I wrote in Open Spaces magazine entitled The Marketing of Medicines to Doctors, Confessions of a Reformed Doctor, etc. Indeed, I admit to enjoying some of these marketing strategies, having had some nice dinners in Portland restaurants, and in fact being an after-dinner speaker on occasion some years ago when asked to talk about insomnia and some of the new treatments. I suppose I was really turned around in a way one day when I opened my email, and there in front of me was an invitation to go to France, to Paris, to a conference, all expenses paid, by one of the drug companies that makes the sleeping medication. And I thought, gee, this is great. I called my wife. I said, how would you like to go to Paris this spring? And then I got home, and thankfully my wife, who's actually more thoughtful in many ways than I am, reminded me that, you know, this $2,000 or $3,000 trip was really going to come out of the pocket of patients in terms of advertising. And I said, you know, you're right. And I started really thinking about this, and I heard a wonderful presentation from Dr. Linda Ganzini in our department, who outlined the growth of marketing to physicians over the last decade or so, and made me really stop and think what was going on. So I did some research on my own and wrote this article. And I'm going to quote from it, but I just, before I do that, last night as I was preparing, I came across on the internet, just by chance, a advertisement from an internet advertising company called MedBanner. Never heard of them before, but anyway, I thought their opening paragraph really summarized the situation in a nutshell. They're trying to sell advertising to pharmaceutical clients, presumably, but their opening statement is, pharmaceutical advertising to physicians. Pharmaceutical advertising to physicians remains a valuable tool in the pharmaceutical marketing mix. The result of the 2003 healthcare poll by Wall Street Journal, online Harris Interactive, shows that 67% of adult Americans trust their doctors to choose the best drugs for them. With physicians prescribing medication to hundreds of patients every month, it's no surprise that 80% of pharmaceutical marketing budgets is spent on advertising to physicians. Now, you know, that fact is little known, I think, by the public and needs to be known. And this bill essentially makes that information available. But going to the article that I wrote, let me just read a few paragraphs. As we know, the cost of new drugs has skyrocketed. If I prescribe Ambien or Sonata, these are trade names for two sleeping pills, I better have a good reason. And they cost about four times as much as some of the older sleeping pills. For example, the cost of 30 tablets of Ambien recently purchased at Albertson's Pharmacy was $81.19. The patient paid $24.34, and Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance paid $56.85. The cost of temazepam, a generic sleeping medication, would have been $17.70 total. Are the newer medications four times better? Why do they cost so much? As we know, Americans spent $190 billion last year, and this was written last year, on pharmaceuticals, 1.8% of U.S. GDP. That averages about $676 per person, or $2,700 for a family. And as we know, these costs have just been going up way beyond the rate of inflation. The primary argument from the big pharmaceutical companies for the rising cost of drugs is the high cost of research and development. But, and here's the rub, pharmaceutical companies spend more on advertising than they do on research and development. And how do they spend this money? How do the big pharma, as they're sometimes called, spend their budget? Who are the consumers? In effect, there are three parties in the usual medication purchase: the doctor, who chooses the drug to prescribe; the patient, who is the ultimate consumer and usually has to pay something out of pocket, a copay; and thirdly, the sponsor, the insurance company, the HMO, the government health provider, the Oregon health plan, whoever it may be, who picks up the remainder of the tab. And, of course, with private health insurance, that sponsor's cost is ultimately passed back to the patient in terms of premiums and to the employer. So it's a complex interaction. It's a complex transaction. the doctor who prescribes the medication may have little appreciation of the cost of the medication. But the doctor is really the main target of marketing. And although direct-to-consumer ads would appear to be directed to the patient, as it's been said, to a large extent they're also directed toward the doctor. The not-so-subtle message is, put some pressure on your doctor to prescribe our drug. The pharmaceutical industry spent about $2.8 billion in 2003 on so-called direct marketing of drugs, but that's a lot less than they spent on the medical profession, $5.8 billion, and that's not accounting the $11.7 billion spent on free samples, which is essentially another marketing method. Now, I'd like to just make reference to one component of the bill, and that is the section in paragraph 1 that refers to the pharmaceutical marketing either directly or through a company on behalf of I'm wondering if people know what that means. What that means is that there are companies, and very large companies, worth billions of dollars currently, called medical education service suppliers. They act as intermediaries between the pharmaceutical clients and the doctors. These are for-profit companies, and I have a rather complete list if people are interested about these companies. There are many of them, and what they do is they subsidize medical education conferences, grand rounds, presentations, symposia, and for example, this trip to Paris probably would have been managed through one of these medical education service suppliers. They get their money primarily from the drug companies. Respected researchers are given handsome honoraria to provide lectures and educational materials that, although not patently biased, are nevertheless never unfriendly to the drug company that is behind the scenes sponsor. CME program regulations require that speakers reveal any financial arrangements with their sponsors, but by going through one of these companies, the drug company is able to obscure their linkage to the program. What's missing in this arrangement is a healthy, adversarial, skeptical relationship between the academician, that is the medical educator, researcher, and the corporate marketer. Instead, there's a gray zone in which the researcher and academician is not easily distinguished from the marketer. So anyway, I'd like to say that this is a bill which will help to clarify the currently very fuzzy medical marketplace when it comes to pharmaceuticals. The doctor makes the decision about which drug to prescribe, ideally by being well informed and keeping the patient's best interest in mind, but the doctor is not bearing the expense and may be unaware of the cost. The good patient tries to follow his doctor's instructions, whatever the cost. The sponsor may be bearing the majority of this expense, but can pass it back to the patient and the employer through insurance premiums. All the medical expenses are mixed together in the insurance premium, and the true cost of the drugs is obscured. This bill would make the costs of marketing more transparent and ask patients to be more aware of what their options are. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Sachs.
Madam Chair, do you want to hold questions at the end of the panel or for each individual witness?
I think it's okay to ask questions now, but I just want to point out that Representative Jackie Dingfelder is here, Representative Jeff Merkley, Representative Terry Beyer, Representative Brad Witt, and, of course, Representative Phil Barnhart, and Representative Arnie Roblin. Thank you so much for attending, and I know Betty Comp had been here also, but I think Betty might have left, so thank you. But now, Representative.
Thank you.
Bob, one of the problems that I've noticed for a long time is not in the direct advertising, but in the use of physicians in the research of products on the way to market, and then their eventual use as experts at conferences like Paris. Your group, you and Al Louie and others, have been involved in doing research on drugs that weren't in weren't under patent anymore. A big piece of your research has been that way. And then I expect you've also been involved in research projects of bringing patented drugs to market. And I wonder if you could Have you ever been invited, for example, to give a speech on drugs that are not under patent that you've been doing research on, as opposed to, have you been treated differently when you do research on Ambien, say, as opposed to...
Representative, could I ask you to describe what patent is for the audience and me?
Well, there are drugs that are maintained for, I think, maybe 17 years. Is that right? I don't remember what the number is right now. After they've been developed by a company and come to market. But there are then uses of drugs, for example, in travel jet lag and other things that Dr. Sachs and his compatriots have done work on that long since have passed out of the ability of a drug company to make the same kind of money on them. And in my mind, one of the major problems has been that the research activities of the drug companies to bring a drug to market produce marketing benefits simultaneously. And in fact, frequently the research is done in a less effective way, but to get more opinion leaders, because the opinion leaders in a community help change the prescribing pattern for the community. And when Dr. Sachs works on, let's say, a product like Ambien, and I don't know if he did or not, he then becomes an expert in that field and can work for the drug company in a very subtle way, giving those kind of speeches on that product because he's been involved in the research that brought that drug to market.
A few comments. I mean, some of the obvious things. Obviously, I don't get any coffee mugs or pens that do not have patented drug names on them, and things like that. But so there is, of course, a great deal more marketing where profits are to be made. I have done both kinds of research. Most of my research in the past has been NIH-sponsored, but in recent years I have done a few clinical trials for a company that's developing, that's GSK, for a drug for restless leg syndrome. I think that the research can be done ethically, but I think that there has to be a line drawn between the investigator as a researcher and then the investigator as a marketer. And, sometimes that gets pretty fuzzy, where the people who've done the research then become kind of a champion for what sounds like their research, but indeed is a champion for their drug. It's another way that drug company influence is active in the marketplace or in doctors' decisions. I think that one of the ways that it's also active that is maybe a bigger issue, but that is the selection of what kinds of research to do. For example, certain kinds of pharmaceutical companies rarely conduct head-to-head trials of let's say their current drug. Is Ambien really better than one of the previously available set of hypnotics? I think it probably is, actually. It's my personal clinical opinion, but when you go to the research literature, you only find one or two very small studies that actually compare the two drugs. And those are not the kind of studies that get sponsored by pharmaceutical companies. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Doctor, for being here. I'm just looking at some of the exemptions under the bill, and one of them is free samples of prescription drugs intended to go to patients. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if this would potentially encourage a drug company to move whatever dollars they were giving a particular clinic or a doctor in free trips to Paris to more drugs just to get that clinic to perhaps sell and move their drugs, and yet that wouldn't be reported. Can you tell me a little bit about how that may impact the...
Well, samples have been in doctor's offices for a long time and are sometimes used to help patients who can't afford to buy their own medication, and from that point of view, they're can be appreciated by clinics. Of course, one of the main reasons they're distributed is not so much for that charitable reason, but because if a patient can be started on a drug through samples, they will often be reluctant to switch to perhaps a less expensive alternative once they have found benefit from a sample. So I can't predict the pharmaceutical company's strategies, but one might anticipate there'd be more sampling if other advertising approaches were restricted.
So you're not concerned about that being exempted and trying and how they might leverage themselves?
Well, I think that because there is this broader benefit, even though it's a kind of a two-edged sword, the sample question, there is some benefit to patients who can't afford their own prescriptions. So I suspect the reason that that exemption exists is to preserve that benefit where it does occur.
Representative Witt.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sack, thank you very much for your testimony. Recognizing that you may not be an expert in business accounting or business economics, would you by chance know the extent to which the drug industry is dependent upon or relies on for its profitability research and development?
I guess I don't have that information readily at hand.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I'd be interested in that information from any
there may be
any further witnesses. I'm interested in Dr. Sachs's comment that prescription drug companies spend more on advertising than research and development, and I was just trying to get a feel for what other industries who appear, I guess, doctor, to be reliant on research and development for their profitability would be similarly placed in terms of their expenditures on advertising.
Great. We'll see if someone else can answer that, Representative. Any other questions? Representative.
Thank you.
We'll get to you.
In your experience, would it be fair to say that the patenting process oftentimes isn't a full 17 years, but because the patent starts when early in the research period at times, it may take quite a number of years to get past the FDA regulations and actually be on the market?
So yeah, the clock starts ticking at a fairly early point in the R&D process. So the 17 years may be restricted quite a bit by the time the drug actually gets to market. That's true.
Follow up. Which would put a lot of pressure on the company to make sure that the expense that they have invested in research can be recouped and leave money enough to research the next drug down the line. But sometimes there is a major pressure put on the pharmaceutical company to make sure that there's money comes in as a profit to that, and I would think that they're spending money on the doctors to try and recoup that major research effort.
I think that's true. I suppose the what needs to be more clearly understood, though, is the relative proportion of spending on research to spending on advertising. I think that's what this bill tries to delineate.
Any other questions? Thank you, Doctor, for waiting. Dr. Ruin Ruge? And could you give your name for the...
Sure. My name is John Ruin Ruge. I am a practicing physician in Skippers, Oregon. I am also employed by OHSU, but I'm here to testify on my own behalf. I'm here in support of this bill, 2817. For the past 18 months, I have been practicing in Skippoos, as a clinic in Skippoos. This is a clinic that has been receiving samples as well as drug company gifts and drug-free lunches for the past 18 months. And after 18 months, I can tell you why they do it, and that's because it works to alter your prescribing habits and what medications you give to patients.
Could you pull the microphone over?
Oh, sure. Is that, yeah. Am I too close, too far away? What I discovered when I arrived at this clinic is that the clinic culture was very centered around the drug industry and drug company gifts. This included everyone from the people who filed the charts to the receptionist to the nursing staff. And the reason is because they benefit more than probably anyone else in the clinic from the freebies. They get the free candy, they get the free lunches, they get the free toys, they get the things for their children to take home that night. And some of my staff, in fact, do rely on the food to take home to their families at night to help support their families, which is a difficult decision for all of us. However, this does alter our prescribing habits in some very poor ways. Looking at the charts and looking at my fellow practitioners in the clinic prescribing habits, it's clear who listens to the drug reps, who takes their information and takes it to heart, and those who use the sample cabinets, because they're the patients who wind up on the inappropriate medications and the very expensive medications for the indications that they're given for. And then sometimes given the wrong medicine for the wrong indication because there's nothing else in the sample closet that the patient can afford. And the idea from the provider standpoint is better to do something than to do nothing. Unfortunately, this is also left to the AMEC in our clinic, which makes it very hard for us to get rid of drug rep and their samples and their gifts, because our staff is dependent on them, and our staff puts some pressure on us as providers to be hospitable and to listen to the drug reps and take their information. Most of this information is very biased. The studies are poorly done, are generally printed into lesser journals, and are often show results which are virtually meaningless and or are statistically non-significant. And when you bring this up to the drug reps, they do not seem to be caring that this is the case of their information. They've become more and more aggressive. They are now starting to track our prescribing habits. The drug reps will know who's prescribing what when they come into the clinic and which clinicians in the clinic target for their particular product. Additionally, they've kind of almost crossed the line in our clinic, and they actually started to approach the nursing staff to start reviewing the chart before the patients put in their rooms and look for certain medications. And if the patient's on medicines, they should bring this to the attention of the doctor and tell the doctor that they should switch the medications around to brand new, newer medications which are more expensive than the medications they are currently on. This was actually an outrage to even my nursing staff, who does not feel that it's their job to decide what medications the patient is on. So this is some of the things that do happen on the ground level with the pharmaceutical industry within a clinic setting. I think this bill will begin to open up and demonstrate to the citizens of Oregon what's going on and where the money is going, so that hopefully they can begin to see how the system is funneled, so when they do go to their physician's office and get a sample, they have some idea where that may be coming from and why that's given to them that day. Now, not to say that drug companies do not offer some benefit to our patients. They certainly do provide us with samples, which we do provide to our patients, oftentimes to those who cannot afford, or at least able to afford, the medications that we are trying to prescribe. Unfortunately, the medications that are given to us in samples are generally the most expensive medication. So when they do run out, and they will, because they never give you enough samples to get everyone in the entire community or through your entire practice through a full month or full 3 months of medication, they are stuck with a rather large bill when they go to the pharmacy, or they're stuck by not taking their medication appropriately, which many do not do. In fact, a patient this week came to me and explained to me that she was given samples for one medication. She cannot afford this medication, so instead of taking it every day as she's directed, she's now taking it once or twice a week, which is worse than not taking the medication at all, which after months of doing this, I finally explained to her that she's just got to stop the medicine because it's not appropriate to be taking it intermittently. So the samples, while they are good, they are definitely a double-edged sword, and something that I am really leaning towards not providing for chronic medical conditions, because they are often taken inappropriately because they're just not enough to go around, and they will not be able to afford them when they go to the pharmacy. They do have the pharmaceutical assistance programs, which are somewhat helpful. Again, these are tenuous. They will give you 3 months supply of medications. They change which medications are available on these assistance programs from month to month. They change the income requirements that are necessary from month to month. So patients may be on their medicine for 3 months, again, might get a 3-month supply, and then they come to you and they are no longer available to get the medication. Maybe their income went up because they're seasonal workers, or maybe their income stayed the same and the drug company changed the rules on how they want to change the program. But they are still without their medication that we feel that they desperately need. So from my own experience and from that, I do believe this bill will begin to shed some light onto how the pharmaceutical industry advertises and promotes medications to physicians, and hope that this will change some of how we prescribe and to make things more evidence-based rather than more promotion-based. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Any questions? Debbie?
Well, Representative Boone? I have two questions for Dr. Blake.
Becky.
I was a little disturbed to hear that how a drug company rep can track someone's prescription, because what about the privacy laws?
My understanding is that they, that when a patient goes to a pharmacy, they have and they turn the prescription in, it obviously has a prescribing physician's number. And so since the pharmacy company is supplying the medication, they are allowed all that information in terms of who's prescribing what. And so that information is available to them.
And that falls within the privacy, the scope of privacy laws?
I don't know for sure.
Could I clarify?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Santa.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone.
Dr. Santa, would you say?
John Santa. There isn't a patient privacy issue here that you need to be concerned about. There is an information issue that's interesting. This came up actually at a panel that a number of us organized at the medical school for second-year medical students and an industry representative system. There are, if you will, clearinghouses that get information from drugstores and other sources of medication that pharmaceutical companies can purchase that basically describes to them on a monthly or quarterly basis everything the three of us prescribe. So the companies know on as frequent basis as they are willing to pay what our prescribing habits are and what has worked in terms of marketing. They don't know patient names,
mm-hmm.
But they know if what they've done has worked to increase the prescribing.
Okay.
One of the questions one of the medical students asked, I think, was insightful. She asked the representative, well, do you give any of this information to the doctor? And, of course, the answer is no. We don't know our own prescribing practices. We don't know, for example, when we're prescribing medicines that have a black box warning. Nobody tells us that. The information's out there, but nobody tells us that. The industry knows that. The industry knows everything about what doctors are prescribing. The patients and doctors know nothing.
Follow up. With Dr. Santa, what can you describe a black box warning?
The FDA, when it has concerns about a drug but doesn't want to pull it off the market, for example, the Vioxx controversies, their concerns about Vioxx were sufficient to pull Vioxx off the market. They had actually put a black box warning on Vioxx 4 years ago. What that means is we get a letter in the mail that says, there's a big problem with this drug, be very careful about prescribing it. That's about it.
They don't tell you what?
Well, they don't tell you. You really don't know ongoing. You're not reminded. You know, you're prescribing a drug that has a black box warning. About 5% of drugs have black box warning. What you've got is an imbalanced information system where, again, in my parlance, the seller knows almost everything. The buyer knows almost nothing, including... You know, oftentimes the prescriber, you know, you got to be reminded there's so much going on. This could be a dangerous drug. I mean, how often do we know we're prescribing a black box warning drug? Not very often.
And my second question.
Could you hold just
sure.
a second? Because I know Representative Merkley has to leave soon.
Oh,
and I'll
sure.
let him ask his question before he leaves.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the chance to assert this. I wanted to make sure I understood a second point that you made in your final testimony. I also was struck by your comments about the pharmaceutical companies tracking what doctors prescribe, certainly new information to me. But did I also understand you to say that representatives come in to the clinic and check the charts of patients or...
No.
Or know what individual patients are receiving and lobby to have those medications changed? Could you clarify that?
I'm sorry, I probably spoke too quickly. The pharmaceutical rep approached my nursing staff and asked my nursing staff to, when they're checking patients in, to be reviewing the charts, you know, their medication list primarily, looking for certain types of medication, and then explain that the nurse should then tell the doctor to switch the patient of medications around to his medication that he was promoting that day.
See, if I understand then, if the reps lobby the nurses to lobby the doctors to switch to certain medicines over others.
Correct. It wasn't so much of a lobbying, but it was explained that they should be on this medicine instead.
I see.
It was.
Thank
it was,
you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Did you have a second question?
I did. And just, it was just, if a patient, and any of the doctors could answer this, I'm sure, if a patient's prescribed or given that samples and a script for a name drug, for example, when they run out of the samples and they fill the script, can they ask the pharmacy to give them a generic? If they can ask, well, how much is this compared to the generic? Can they do that?
Yeah, I can start with that. They can. The funny thing is drug companies never provide us samples of generic medications. So we only have samples of brand name medications or medications that aren't available in generic form at this time. It would make so that's not going to happen.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Well, first question, Representative Boone already asked on the thank you for the tracking prescription habits. Who sets the rules in your clinic? Are you the head of the clinic?
I'm currently the medical director, yeah.
Medical director on who can solicit and when and those types of things. Do you set those rules?
Well, I do, and with obviously with political buy-in from everyone in the clinic, I would be very, very unpopular very quickly if I made some decisions around this, and that's what has been so difficult. However, we as a clinic have recently, and this was really based on the recent approach to the nursing staff to be looking at the different medications, we've put a temporary halt on drug rep lunches at this time. We're still receiving samples in our clinic and still information from drug reps.
So based on a rule you set in your clinic, you're no longer accepting free meals from...
Temporarily, we're on hold.
If you eliminated the sample, another thing you said was the sample, the irony of the sample program. So if you set rules, okay, we're not going to do free lunches, now we're not going to accept samples. I'm curious as to what do you do for the patient, because you described that a patient that gets on samples that cost more in the long term,
mm-hmm.
We do it because, well, I mean, the samples are in the office, so if we said, okay, I'm not going to receive those samples anymore as a policy
right.
within my office, which might not be politically acceptable, but that's your decision and you would stand on that. What would you do for the patient coming in then? Would you prescribe them a generic drug right from the get-go?
Exactly. Right.
Why don't you just do that?
Well, I do. Others don't. Patients hear about drugs on TV. They're used to drugs. They're used to getting samples. This has been ingrained in the practice for a good 10 years. They're used to getting samples, and they're used to thinking that a newer drug is a better drug, and they're promoted on TV, aren't they? Aren't they, doctor? And it's hard to get them out of that frame of mind.
Tell them to turn their TV off.
But again, it all works.
Representative Bingley.
Thank you. John, you just touched on a point of the imbalance of information, and I'd like you to follow up a little bit on that, and I think Dr. Garland will be along, so soon we can talk a little bit more about it. And a point that Representative Barnhart made in his opening statement, the the classic economic model is a buyer and a seller in a free market, and the price affects the demand. You know, I took all that microeconomic stuff. The interesting issue here is that it's not clear who the buyer is it? And that's one of the complexities of this game. I mean, the buyer might be the drug company. It might be the insurance company. The buyer might be the patient, but the real buyer is the physician, because it's the physician that purchases it. And physician behavior is something I've studied for the last 40 years, as you have for a few years less than that. And how do we deal with the clear understanding that it's the physician that writes the prescription and therefore is the purchaser, even though that physician is not dealing with the consequence of price in any direct way, is trying to think about the patient, but it's almost never thinking about the insurance company. And so you have both the question of the imbalance of power that you talk about, the imbalance of knowledge power, but you also have the imbalance of incentive here. It's very hard to understand where the incentive to behave rationally is, and I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yeah. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee. It's an evolving world. I think in the world that you and I started out in the 60s and 70s, I think we could rely more on professionalism, mm-hmm. on a professional code. And in that world, I think physicians, in many respects, were more of a purchaser, but they were a professional. It's a very different world now. I think it is getting more like a market, because I think patients are responsible for paying more and more for their prescription drugs. And I think it's... My prediction in 2006 is the Medicare prescription drug benefit comes online. You're going to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Medicare folks saying, "Doctor, remember the donut. You've got, you know, $2,500 of my dollars to spend before I'm in the donut. Think about my, you know, financial well-being." You also, I think, have a small number of very large companies whose business model is not to compete on price, but to compete on controlling information in a variety of ways, like we've heard, through advertising, sampling, incentives, etc. They do not want to compete on price if they can avoid it. And hey, that's an economic strategy. In many sense, I think doctors are going to become more like, if you pardon the expression, you're a stockbroker. They're representing your interest. They should be focused on your interest, but given how huge the potential incentives of a third party are, government needs to control that, needs to referee that, needs to make the rules. When somebody breaks the rules, they need to be punished. It's good to see folks who've manipulated stocks to their benefit, not to their clients, go to jail. That's a real market. So I think we're evolving, and in some ways this bill represents the fact that as professional as they may be, some doctors are going to struggle to do that. George Lundberg, the editor of JAMA, has a nice bell-shaped curve that he describes the physician population. Basically says at the two ends you have 5% saints and 5% crooks. In the middle you have 45% of physicians who act as professionals and 45% who act as business people. It's those 45% who act as business people who we're really talking about today. And I think government needs to play a more active role in refereeing the rules around how industry is going to influence those 45%.
If I can just summarize what I think I've heard you say, John, and as I say, I'm sure Dr. Garland will get into this. The extent to which we believe in capitalism, the extent to which we believe in the free market, even if you go back to Adam Smith's original writings on the free market, the notion of the role of government was to make sure the free market was free. I mean, it was anti-monopolistic. I mean, if there was a role in the government, it was to make sure that the market was free. And what we're talking about here is a market that's not free. And this bill is an attempt to provide more. One of the basis of free market is the information. This is to provide more equity of information, is what I hear you saying. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, you hit the nail on the head. If we believe in markets, then we should believe in refereeing markets to be free and truly competitive. And when you get down to individual purchasers, this isn't even David versus Goliath. It's just not fair what's going on.
Thank you, Dr. Sam.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have more speakers on our list. Could you hold this, Representative? Is this one that you particularly need for this panel? Well, we have about a dozen more people are wanting to testify.
Appreciate that. Let me just say one thing, if, with your permission, Mr. Chair. When I graduated from dental school, I don't think I really ever signed a statement, but I felt that it had been inculcated into me, as I'm sure it had been in each of you, that it was the patient's interests that were summum bonum. And I don't know whether things have changed since then. I do know that physicians don't sign the Hippocratic Oath anymore. But it seems to me the problem here is the morality and the ethics of we in the professions. That if everybody refused to take any of these freebies, there'd be no problem. The drug companies would figure out a different way to get their product out. But the problem is the 45 or the 90% of the middle who are willing to compromise their morality, basically, and change the focus from the patient. What's best for the patient? Is it a generic drug? Is it a poor patient that I prescribe a generic drug and then help them, give them some money to help buy that for some time? That's pretty idealistic. But it's really the morality of we, the doctor, that's at fault here. And not the market is going to try and do anything they can. If we reject them, then we'll have a good society.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. Well, I think part of morality is a profession agreeing to a code. The American Medical Association's code of ethics, as I read it, and Mike is more expert at this than I think would say that much of what you've heard described here today is unethical. That doesn't work in our society.
Doctors, you can change the American Medical Association, right?
Democratic
society.
The American Medical Association got into some pretty serious ethical problems with a company called Sunbeam in the 90s.
So you're proving the point that it's the morality of the profession.
But the morality of the profession requires some monitoring. I'm happy to see colleagues here who support this. I think most physicians would support this because we would like our colleagues to monitor themselves better, and I think this measure would help with that. Let me just tell a story. I have a colleague who over many years, he and I have traded discussions. In the 90s, he happens to practice in a state where there were a lot of controversies about managed care. I worked for Blue Cross at the time, and we used to argue about the ethics of capitation. And of course the burden was on me. He was telling me the last couple of years how he's treated by the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, there's weeks that go by where he and his wife don't make dinner any day. They get dinners brought in by the pharmaceutical companies. And I said, you know, it sounds to me like things have reversed now. It sounds you felt strongly that physicians who were capitated should disclose that to patients. It's strong. It I feel strongly maybe you should now disclose to your patients that the pharmaceutical companies are taking you out to dinner every night. And he said, oh, no, no, I'm a fee-for-service doctor, John. I'm just providing a fee for a service. And I said, what's the service? What's the service are you providing? A long pause. It's influencing.
Quick question, yeah. Representative.
You said you'd support this. I guess I have a question. What if we changed in line 5 that all doctors would report? So whatever comes into his clinic, he has to report it versus putting the back on the pharmaceutical companies. Going back to what good representative's talking about the profession, would you support legislation that would say all doctors have to report the gifts and the things that they take?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, I would, yes.
Thank back, you. It looked like you had something to say, and then we're going to go to the next panel.
Well, I just wanted, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, to just bring up the issue of sort of masking effects that occur in marketing through these intermediate companies. If I go to a conference and I hear a speaker, I may or may not know to what extent that speaker has been supported through a pharmaceutical company. So it's not quite as easy nowadays, I don't think, to understand where the line should be drawn. I just wanted to comment on that.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Appreciate you taking the time this morning to testify. We will now take testimony in opposition to this bill. I think Jim Gardner is here. Is anyone else who would like to testify in opposition to this bill? Dr. Sack, before you leave, could you give us the information that you had today just so we can make copies for the rest of the committee? You had quoted, I think, from an article, not just your own, but another one that on the Internet that you'd gotten last evening. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm here today representing Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America.
Dressed in black.
I was planning to dress in all in black, but I couldn't find the appropriate garments in my closet. Best I can do. I'm going to, I've provided you with written testimony and also with two additional documents which are cross-referenced in that testimony. The first is the Pharma Code on interactions with healthcare professionals. And I think this is particularly relevant in light of the colloquy that just occurred with regard to the need for self-regulation by the medical profession with regard to emphasizing and continuing to emphasize the need for keeping the interest of the patient front and center. The second is a document which I want to draw your attention to, and that is a compliance, it's called the OIG, which is Office of Inspector General Compliance Program Guidance for Pharmaceutical Manufacturers, issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. And these documents are related in that the OIG guidelines cross-reference the Pharma Code. And with that identification of the documents, let me proceed to my testimony. Pharma respectfully opposes House Bill 2817's attempt to require reporting of proprietary marketing information to the Department of Justice. Specifically, House Bill 2817 requires, subject to some exceptions, and I'm going to go into one of those in some detail in just a moment, that manufacturers annually disclose to the Department of Justice the value, nature, and purpose of any gift, fee, payment, subsidy, or other economic benefit that the manufacturer provides to prescribers, dispensers of prescription drugs, healthcare facilities, and/or administrators of healthcare facilities in the state in connection with detailing, promotional, or other marketing activities. Failure to properly report could result in a civil penalty of $10,000 per violation, and I think that violation would mean each instance of the provision of a thing of value. The pharmaceutical industry, to be quite candid, has recognized the potential problem of inappropriate gifting, inappropriate remuneration to prescribers and other healthcare professionals. That has been recognized, and as a result of that, the industry has issued its own voluntary code, the Pharma Code, which I gave you a copy of, which is related to communications with healthcare practitioners. And if you will go through that, I think you will agree that it places guidelines and limitations on this kind of activity that are appropriate. You may have some quibbles around the edges, but I think you would agree that if people follow that guideline, they will be engaged in appropriate activity, not the kind of activity that you've heard described today. These guidelines, in effect, prohibit quid pro quos between manufacturers and healthcare professionals. Now, one of the questions that has come up is, well, gee, isn't this guideline simply voluntary? Don't we need the hammer of government enforcing it? And in fact, we have the hammer of government enforcing it at a federal level through the OIG program guidance. And the ultimate hammer, the OIG is essentially, that report is essentially a set of admonitions, of guidelines that healthcare practitioners and manufacturers are admonished to follow. Now, what happens if, for instance, a quid pro quo, substantial quid pro quo, is offered in return for prescribing drugs for a patient, let's say, that's on Medicare or Medicaid? There is in existence a federal anti-rebate, anti-kickback law, which is which carries criminal penalties. And if you turn over to page 23734 on the guidelines, I'm just going to read that very briefly to you. The anti-kickback statute is a criminal prohibition against payments in any form, whether the payments are direct or indirect, and we heard a little bit about the direct and indirect situation a minute ago, made purposefully to induce or reward the referral or generation of federal health care business. The anti-kickback statute addresses not only the offer or payment of anything of value for patient referrals, but also the offer or payment of anything of value in return for purchasing, leasing, ordering, or arranging for or recommending the purchase, lease, or ordering of any item or service reimbursable in whole or part by a federal health care program. Now, that's not the entire world of prescribing, obviously, but it's a doggone big part of it, particularly with Medicare Part D taking effect. So I would submit that that industry has recognized this issue, and certainly the federal government has recognized it and given specific guidance as to what happens when you have what amounts to kickback or improper remuneration. I want to turn next to a specific problematic part of this bill, and this is the problem of trade secrets. The bill, to its credit, recognizes that this issue exists, because in line 21 through 23, the statement is made, the Department of Justice shall keep confidential all information reported under subsection 1 of this section that qualifies as a trade secret as that term is described in ORS 192.501. The problem is ORS 192.501, which is an exception to the public records law. And I'm just going to read you briefly, some segments, but this is very important, some segments from the official Attorney General's Public Records Manual that describes what I would call, I can only characterize as a porous exception. And it says this, all of the exemptions described in 192.501 are conditional. They exempt certain types of information from disclosure unless the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance. The applicability of these exemptions is conditioned on the extent to which recognized governmental and private interests in confidentiality outweigh the public interest in disclosure. In other words, the policy is that disclosure decisions should be based on balancing those public interests that favor disclosure of governmental records against those interests that favor government confidentiality, with the presumption always being in favor of disclosure. And generally, that's a pretty good thing. That's a pretty good policy, a basic policy of the public records law, which is a disclosure law, not a confidentiality law. But what it means is that this, in fact, does not protect confidential information in the hands of the Department of Justice if some party seeks to have compel public disclosure under our public records law. That particular defect in the bill is similar to one which led to an injunction being issued in the U.S. District Court of Maine in the PCMA case on July 7, 2004. And the ultimate problem is not merely that it is enjoinable. It's a situation calling for an injunction, but that when disclosure occurs, the courts have held that if it is of confidential proprietary information, that is a taking under federal law, which means that the state can be liable under Section 1983, and that liability is without regard to the tort claims limit. So I think an unintended consequence of this bill could be to subject the state to substantial exposure for takings liability under Section 1983. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Freeman.
Jim, thank you for testifying today. I think your opinion on this is important to us. We had a conversation yesterday where I described what I was inarticulately talking about earlier in the day, and that's when a drug company brings a product to market, it has alternatives on how to do that research, the pre-approval studies. It could hire three large universities to get, say, 1,500 patients each in the study, and then there'll be 4,500 patients, and it could happen very quickly. Or to get that same 4,500 patients, it could hire 100 doctors to get 45 patients in and use the big companies there are to manage that. At the end of the research time, there are 45 opinion leaders, one in almost every market or two in some of the markets that have been involved in the research. You can do what Dr. Sack talked about. Go off and talk about their research, yeah, and their drug. And there's no disclosure at that point. I wonder if you could turn to the preamble of your book, which I find interesting. You don't have... Do you?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, you're... Nice book and nice information. The last line of the preamble says it does not address relationships with clinical investigators relating to pre-approval studies.
And I'm sorry, Representative Greenberg, I'm
on the thing called the preamble.
And yes.
The very last sentence. Well, there are page numbers here.
Page three.
Okay. The last line on page three.
Yes.
It says it does not address relationships with clinical investigators relating to pre-approval studies. And one of the things that I worry about the most, because I've been involved in these studies both ways. I've been involved in studies funded by the drug companies. I've been involved in studies funded by NIH, and I've been involved in studies jointly funded between the drug companies and NIH. That seems to be one of the most important places to have disclosure about the relationship between the drug companies and these people who will then, at the end of the trial, become the experts in the country on this drug. Yet it seems to me that relationship is excluded by this the standard. Do you have any comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, I fear that you know much more about this the pre-market research enterprise than I do. I do not know why that exclusion is there. I will be delighted to inquire, though, if that would be helpful
to you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Were there any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Please.
And then Brett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gardner, it seems to me like this may not be the level at which this type of bill should be carried out. At the federal level, creating one simple form that if this were to be passed, it really should be on the federal level, because it seems to me if, and we do this in state legislatures all the time, create a bill here, create a bill in Minnesota, create a bill in Arkansas, and they all different, and everybody's, and one company has to report in 49 or 50 different ways. Could you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I would concur, and I would also add that, in fact, the OIG guidance seeks to do precisely that, not so much in the context of disclosure, but in the context of penalizing with criminal penalties the kind of inappropriate conduct that that has been the subject of our discussion today. But I would concur that if there were to be a policy, it should be a uniform policy at the federal level.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gardner, I was wondering if you could give me a feel for there's been a testimony that this is a non-competitive market in the drug industry, and I was wondering if you could give me the market concentration ratios within that industry, say for the 10, 5, and 3?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, I do not have that, but I'll be delighted to get that for you. Can I get again
the percentage of the market that would be controlled by the largest 10 companies, the largest 5,
okay,
the largest 3?
I will be delighted to get that for you.
And also, maybe you know this, or if you don't, if you could get me that, I'd appreciate it as well. The industry average for the percent of capital outlays spent on research and development by the drug companies, or the drug industry, rather.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that at my fingertips, but I'm pretty confident I can get that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gardner, the doctors that were up here previously agreed that they would amend line 5, that all doctors and clinics and so forth would be the ones to report. Where would you stand on that if we changed that around?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, I would need to think about that a little bit, but it's an interesting idea. And I guess what I found, I related to that question, that I found something I learned today, which is doctors no longer sign up for the Hippocratic Oath. That kind of surprised me.
Alternative oath.
I see. Well, I would like to study that option, Representative Cameron.
Okay.
Follow up.
One more question. Is your group, the research and manufacturers, are they involved in the free drug program that goes on here in the state of Oregon? Can you describe for the committee what that is, and if this were to pass, would it affect that free drug program?
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, let me first describe it and then attempt to venture an answer with regard to your question. The programs run by all of the member companies, I believe, of pharma, provide free drugs on an ongoing basis to low-income Oregonians that lack prescription drug coverage. That program is currently serving in excess of 93,000 Oregonians with an average of 2.2 prescriptions. So just by way to benchmark that's roughly four times the size of OHP standard. And it's a very important program that we're intent upon attempting to expand through a variety of strategies, which you'll be hearing about next week. The issue that
just a comment, and Mr. Gardner was very influential in helping us get SBA 75 passed in the last session, which was our bulk purchasing, the first shot at the bulk purchasing. We hope it'll be as influential in helping expand it in this session.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Greenland. The issue, the way a lot of those programs work, not all, but a lot of them, is that the physician essentially signs an application form that goes into the drug company, and the prescription drug comes back to the physician's office for it then to be dispensed to the patient, and I believe often refills go back through the pharmacy. But the important point for purposes of this bill is that the initial order goes to the physician's office, and the question that comes up, and it's a question that I would encourage Representative Cameron and you to actually pose to legislative counsel and see if they can give you a quick definitive answer. I believe that it is, unless my analysis is flawed, that those constitute something of value going into the physician's office, even though they later make their way to the patient. And I would offer as a sort of textual support for that the fact that this bill excludes samples, which are, in economic terms, much the same. They are items that go into the physician's office but later make their way to the patient. So the net effect of what I'm saying, I guess, is that I think that perhaps inadvertently the sponsors of this bill or legislative council have created a situation where you are, in effect, disincenting the provision of free drugs to those 93,000 Oregonians and hopefully many more who really depend on them. And I would urge Representative Cameron that that question be posed directly to legislative counsel, and that we all learn the answer to that question.
Thank you. Representative Witt, do you have another question?
Madam Chair, actually just a comment for the record. In Dr. Santa's comments relative to a potential amendment for line number 5, I did not hear him suggesting substitution of physician reporting for pharmaceutical manufacturing companies reporting.
Thank you for noting that. Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you. We have another panel. Earl Louis, Kate Newhall first. And then we're going to be calling Earl Louis, Rick Bennett, and Andy Miller. Kate is representing Dr. Alan Bates, who is a state senator.
Good morning. I'm Kate Newhall. I am Senator Alan Bates' legislative assistant, and I'm going to read his testimony this morning because he can't be here. So I'll be channeling Dr. Bates here. I think she's handing out what I'm going to read, too.
Go ahead, Kate.
Go ahead? Okay. I apologize for not being able to be here today in person to give this testimony. I'm attending legislative business in Medford today, and I'm grateful to the committee for allowing my legislative assistant, Kate Newhall, to read my testimony to you this morning. As a former pharmaceutical representative and a practicing physician, I'm very familiar with drug reps and their business. I'm fully aware that in the recent past, attempts to sway physicians in prescribing specific medications have escalated to inappropriate levels. I'm also aware that the pharmaceutical industry has taken steps to reverse the trend and has had some success in doing so. With that said, there is still room for more reform. Increased reform and disclosure will benefit physicians, pharmacists, and patients. I'm proud of the work that I did as a representative for a pharmaceutical company, a position that I held for nearly 5 years. I took pride in detailing and informing physicians about the medications my company produced. I had no expense account for physicians and only gave out pens and mugs without any issue or ethical qualms. Drug representatives, much like the lobby in this building, can be helpful sources of information. I believe that the relationship between a physician and the pharmaceutical representatives should be much more like our relationship with the lobby. Just as lobby can be helpful in learning about and resolving issues, pharmaceutical representatives have a place in the process as well. However, just as there have been examples of excessive behavior by lobby, this can just as easily happen within the pharmaceutical industry. Holding the pharmaceutical industry to roughly the same standard as we maintain in this building is what is appropriate and why I support this bill. I do believe that the $25 minimum gift value is too low and should be increased to $100, which is more in line with the gift-giving limits in this building. Disclosure of gifts given is good policy and benefits all those involved. Thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to have this testimony presented to you today. I wish I could have been here myself to do it in person.
Thank you, Kate. And extend our thanks to Dr. Bates.
I will.
Thank you. So now we have Earl Louie, Rick Bennett, and Andy Miller. If you come up to the table, please. Thank you for waiting. Dr. Garland? Great.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Earl Louie. I'm a senior attorney with Consumers Union, and Consumers Union is the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports magazine. I'm here from Consumers Union's West Coast office in San Francisco, California. And I've prepared some written testimony, and attached to the written testimony are some articles from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and the New England Journal of Medicine that address this issue of pharmaceutical company marketing to physicians. I know you've already heard a lot of great testimony today and very informative testimony. I'll try not to repeat the points that have already been made by the first panel of physicians, but I do want to address the testimony from the gentleman from Pharma regarding the industry's voluntary policies on gift giving and the Federal Office of Inspector General guidelines. And the main point about those policies are, again, that they are voluntary. The pharma guidelines were adopted, I believe, about 3 years ago, and yet, even to this day, in just last month, a top official at the Food and Drug Administration, in the article from the New York Times that is attached to this, talks about this. The acting director of operations for the FDA said that the abuses still continue, and this is 3 years after the adoption of the pharma guidelines. It's the article that's headlined, "Drug Makers Are Still Giving Gifts to Doctors, FDA Officials Tell Senators." And so this article came out just a month ago, and the industry has had these guidelines on the books for 3 years, and yet, according to a high FDA official, they're still not following the guidelines. And just one comment about the Federal Office of Inspector General. Again, those are just guidelines. They don't have the force of law. They're simply recommendations to drug companies about how to do their business. And the gentleman from Pharma talked about the federal anti-kickback statute, which is a criminal statute. Again, that would require criminal action being brought by a U.S. attorney to try to prove that there's a kickback going on, and the standard for that obviously is very high. The definition of kickback is that you're trying to purposely induce or award the referral or generation of federal health care business. So you have to prove criminal intent. It would require the U.S. attorney to get involved. And I think the final point about the OIG guidance is that it applies only to Medicare and Medicaid. It's since the federal, it's to, preserve federal taxpayer funds. So it wouldn't even address all the marketing that goes on in the private health insurance market. And just the final point about voluntary approaches, based on what we've seen in the past 3 years with pharma's noncompliance with its own policy, questions on this committee have talked about the responsibility of individual physicians to use good judgment and in accepting or not accepting gifts. But I would just point out to the committee that the same standard applies to pharma also, that if they have a voluntary guidance or policy on the books that they are not following, that should be of interest to this committee and to policymakers throughout this country. So In my opinion, this bill is needed because these voluntary approaches haven't worked and won't work because, as the physicians here earlier testified, the incentives to pharmaceutical companies to do this kind of marketing are so overwhelming that they will not be able to self-regulate, will not be able to police themselves. And so action at the state level is necessary to try to address that issue. Just a few other points, Madam Chair, just to emphasize. Again, as you've heard today, the very point of this kind of marketing to doctors is to increase the sales of each company's drugs. And I think the appropriate question to ask is this kind of marketing out of control or not, or how does it compare? I think as some of the members of this committee have raised, how does it compare to other industries? Well, again, just one statistic that I believe wasn't mentioned earlier is that when you look at the number of drug salespersons and drug or detailers, the ratio in 2003 was one detailer to every 2.5 physicians. So I think, again, you have to ask yourself, is there any other industry that has one salesperson for every 2.5 buyers for its product? That's unprecedented, and I would argue is a sign that this kind of marketing is out of control. You've also heard the physicians talk about inappropriate marketing or inappropriate prescribing patterns because of changes in prescribing patterns due to marketing. Just want to point out the examples of Vioxx, Bextra, and Celebrex. I think, in the headlines about their withdrawal and the problems with those drugs, I think one point that may not have gotten as much attention is that those drugs really shouldn't have been prescribed to the millions of people who did get those prescriptions. And that's because when you look at the medical scientific evidence, those drugs weren't any more effective at relieving pain than things like generic ibuprofen and other much less costly drugs. And again, Oregon's been a leader in looking at systematic reviews and of evidence through its DERP program. So I think the question you have to ask yourself is how did those three drugs become three of the top 10 selling drugs in the country? And a lot of that was due to the kind of marketing to physicians and to consumers. Those drugs really should have been prescribed only to people who had ulcers or gastrointestinal bleeding, people who really needed, would have had complications from side effects from other pain relievers. But I, for one, for example, was given Celebrex when I sprained my ankle to relieve the pain. And my doctor told me, oh, it's a new drug, here, try it out. But, it's a really good drug. And I think, again, the tendency is everyone seems to think that the newer drug is necessarily better when the evidence doesn't always bear that out. So that's why this issue is an important one to address. And the final point that I'd like to make, again, that's been made a little bit, is that this does lead to increasing costs of health care, both for state purchasers like the Oregon Health Plan and also in the private health insurance market. When you have drugs like Vioxx and Celebrex being prescribed instead of generic ibuprofen, I think the cost differential is 5-6 times for Vioxx and Celebrex compared to ibuprofen. It is a big cost driver in the system for state budgets and in the private insurance market for employers and health insurers. So this kind of reporting, this bill will help shed needed light on this issue. As the physician said, it will help not only the public and lawmakers, but also physicians realize what's going on here in Oregon with drug company marketing to physicians. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Louie. Any questions? I have a question. Unfortunately, Representative Anderson had to leave. He has a meeting in South part of the state soon. But he brought up the issue that perhaps it would be better, rather than this be a state law, that it would be a federal law. Does the Consumers Union have a position on that?
I understand the point that it might make sense to have some uniformity, but on the other hand, state laws are different in lots of different areas. I mean, again, just to make the most obvious analogy with reporting of campaign contributions and lobbying expenditures, the 50 states have all sorts of different requirements on the books for that. Companies who give money to campaigns and who spend money on lobbying all have to comply with those types of requirements. So, and that's just one example out of many. So I don't see the need to do something at the federal level. If they were to do something, I think that would be a step forward. But, I think it's perfectly appropriate for states, particularly as purchasers of health, of purchasers of prescription drugs for public programs like Medicaid, it's perfectly appropriate to demand some accountability from this industry.
And are there any states that currently have such a law?
Maine and Vermont do, yes.
And do you know the results of that law?
They were recently passed, and I'm afraid I don't have that information. I could get back to you, Madam Chair, about that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just close with just one other point? And I just want to just respond to Representative Greenlich's point in his opening statement. I'm glad you returned to the committee. But the emails that you referred to in your opening statement were sent by Consumers Union members and Consumer Report subscribers who are concerned about this issue. But I want to tell you that I've heard your concerns very closely. I will convey all your concerns to the appropriate folks, and we'll take them very seriously into consideration. So thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Whitman.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You mentioned that Maine and Vermont have similar laws. Are you aware of any cases that have been brought in either of those states regarding takings relative to the reporting of the information requested in this bill?
I am not. I'm sorry. I don't have that information either one way or the other.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Bennett, I think I gave you the title of doctor earlier.
Thank you very much.
For the record, Rick Bennett, representing AARP Oregon, with 460,000 members statewide in the state. Actually, in a former life, I was an executive director of a local medical society, but it did not provide me with that title, unfortunately. You have my written comments. I'd like to make just a few statements related to the Vermont law, which was mentioned. I provided you with a copy of the first report that was issued by the Vermont Attorney General, which was issued in February 2004. And despite a state population of only 620,000 and less than 2,500 doctors, the pharmaceutical industry spent $2,466,000 in the fiscal year 2002-03. I would mention that the Vermont law is very similar, almost exactly the same language as what you have before you in House Bill 2817. The direct payments in the forms of fees, cash, checks, honoraria, and donations accounted for over half of that total. Upwards of $500,000 was spent on free meals. On a national basis, this would amount to an expenditure of $1.14 billion in such marketing. Vermont's law provides useful information on how pharmaceutical manufacturers distribute money within the medical community to market their pharmaceuticals. I think it's also noteworthy to mention that the Vermont report reflects just a portion of the actual marketing costs. Only gifts and other forms of payments, such as this bill requires as well, are included. Advertising costs, free samples, and the salary of the company's detailers are excluded, as well as compensation related to clinical trials, medical education grants, and drug rebates and discounts. This bill really is a very modest form of seeking information related to this type of marketing practice. And I think it's been clearly stated that it's not a level playing field we're dealing with here. The pharmaceutical manufacturers have all the information and consumers have none. I think it's important to remember that this bill doesn't prohibit any of these marketing tactics. It just provides us with information about them. And perhaps that information would allow us to make better decisions on how perhaps we should combat that type of marketing practice, whether it's utilizing evidence-based research, preferred drug lists, utilizing and enforcing preferred drug lists with such things such as prior authorization, and other measures that might serve to counteract those kind of marketing tactics. I'd also like to respond to the suggestion related to state versus federal legislation. Certainly, uniform model acts are always good, but I think the states often are the leaders in this type of legislation, and until enough states actually approve legislation like this, there's no reason for the federal government necessarily to step in. There certainly needs to be a certain amount of a way or acceptance, perhaps, before it's really needed to look at federal legislation so that all states are governed in a similar fashion. Let me just close by suggesting or letting you know that we support this bill because we believe, AARP believes that marketing disclosure laws illuminates one of the reasons why prescription drugs cost so much. Disclosure laws, particularly those that track payments received by individual prescribers, allow state governments and policymakers and consumers to gauge the direct impact of marketing on prescribing patterns. And disclosure laws help policymakers determine the need for countervailing measures such as evidence, and I've mentioned this already. Again, we support this measure. We think it's a good first effort. It's very modest in its approach, and we urge your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Andy Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to hopefully add a little different twist to some of the information you have today. I say ditto to the people that spoke before me. We are here today in support of House Bill 2817. Common Cause is a Washington, D.C.-based citizens lobbying organization whose mission is open, honest, and accountable government. The tagline on our logo is Holding Power Accountable. I agreed to testify on behalf of the Oregon Common Cause members because we believe the pharmaceutical industry is very powerful and that they should be held accountable. The industry influences who is elected with their ability to make unlimited campaign contributions in Oregon. Common Cause Oregon spends majority of our resources trying to corral these unlimited contributions. The industry influences policy decisions through extensive lobbying. The reporting of these lobbying expenditures is not done until well after the session ends. We are working to improve lobby disclosure laws so that this influence will become evident. The public has the right to know how the industry influences not only the policy decisions, but also how physicians are influenced by to prescribe particular drugs. We believe that power should be held accountable. This bill is a step in that direction.
Thank you. Any questions? The representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bennett is one of your 460,000 members. I'd like to welcome you here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate your statement. You've mentioned a good bit of reference here to Vermont. Are you aware of any successful taking claims in the Vermont courts?
Again, for the record, Rick Bennett, I'm not. I have sent a message to our national office to seek a more current status on any litigation that might be involved in the state, but I have not received that information at this time.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your staying to give testimony today. We have the next panel would be Dr. Mike Garland, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and Krista Shively. And Representative Greenleaf, you have something to read?
Yes.
This panel is coming up.
I'd like to put it in the record. I received an email from a physician constituent, Dr. Jenny Pompilio, who's a board member of Physicians for Social Responsibility on this bill. Dr. Pompilio pointed out that Physicians for Social Responsibility haven't had a chance to discuss the bill, so therefore they weren't taking an official position, but that she, as a board member, strongly supports the bill, and just wanted us to note that for the record.
Great. And would you make sure that the whole committee will have a copy of that, Representative? Thank you. Dr. Mike Garland.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. I'm glad to have the opportunity to be here. My name is Michael Garland, and I offer this testimony as a private citizen. I'm a retired professor from Oregon Health and Science University, and I should clarify, although I do have the title doctor, it's not, as my children used to say, not the kind of doctor that helps people. It's a degree in philosophy and religious studies.
A real doctor.
A real doctor, right. My work during the past 25 years has been in the field of medical ethics education, and I've focused especially on health policy issues, particularly access to care, financing of care, and cost control in medical care. And I'd like to make 4 points in support of this bill. The first is that this bill wisely allows physicians and others who are licensed to prescribe medications access to knowledge about the scope of promotional efforts by the pharmaceutical industry. As Dr. Greenlick, another doctor, has pointed out, this really seems to be an adjunct and a supportive measure to keep the market free and full of the appropriate information on both sides. It's fair, it's appropriate that marketing prescription drugs has to focus on the gatekeepers who have decision authority over the utilization of the drugs. This bill, I think, is a soft form of regulation that leaves the pharmaceutical industry perfectly free to promote its product to those who have prescribing authority. And it enhances the liberty of physicians and others to interpret the significance of the industry's promotional investments. Rational exercise of liberty relies on possessing valid information. This bill makes objective information available to those with prescribing authority. It makes sense to me on that score. Secondly, an issue that hasn't been addressed, although was raised in terms of physicians no longer taking a Hippocratic Oath, but I want to address that. I think this bill will assist medical students weigh the pros and cons of the debate about undue influence from the pharmaceutical industry that has, whether anyone likes it or not, has become part of the intellectual environment of medical education. The students hear about it, they debate it among themselves, there is a session organized in the required curriculum that looks at that issue. This bill will help provide appropriate information for making judgments about that. For the record, at Oregon Health and Science University Medical School, and probably across the country in most medical schools, students on entry to medical school go through a rather significant ritual called the white coat ceremony, in which they are invested with a white coat as a reminder to them that they are moving into a profession that has a code and has responsibilities. And the students at Oregon Health and Science University do take not the Hippocratic Oath, but they take a modern equivalent of that called the Oath of Geneva, and that's common across the country. So in fact, the profession, as a profession, takes its sense of personal responsibility for living up to a code of patient first very seriously, and makes quite a bit of business about that. And it is addressed in the required curriculum. The third point is that I think this bill is a useful adjunct to ongoing work in Oregon by the Health Resources Commission that focuses on rational prescribing on objective evidence of cost effectiveness in drug utilization. This HRC work gives policymakers and prescribing physicians access to objective information about clinical effectiveness. The HB 2817 will add new data that will make visible in Oregon's health policy landscape important contextual factors that also play a part in the prescribing decisions. So it doesn't do everything, but it does an important new piece. Finally, as has been indicated, we have a serious problem of cost control of health care in the United States. It's growing at a rate of that simply can't be sustained. It already accounts for 15% of our gross domestic product. And we need, as a state, as a nation, to get some reasonable control of the overall costs of health care. And getting to a rational, cost-effective level of expenditure for drug therapy is not the whole answer, but it's a significant piece of the answer. On the one hand, we don't want excessive prescribing practices based on seductive influence by the drug industry, but we don't want low-cost prescribing practices based on an unfounded rejection of information just because it comes via promotional activities. So this bill comes down on the side of liberty through information. It leaves rational decision-making where I think it belongs, in the hands or in the control of those who are licensed to prescribe medications and their patients. I believe this bill contributes a desirable feature to the health policy landscape in Oregon, and I urge you to take it forward.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Goldberg.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. You've had a lot of testimony this morning. I will be very brief and just put this bill in the context of, I believe, a larger conversation that's going on in the state and in the legislature right now, which is really a conversation about transparency within healthcare, and it's about transparency of cost and quality information. I spent the greater part of my day on Wednesday and on Thursday with a variety of different groups of physicians, hospitals, insurers, and others, working on ways that we can actually make healthcare information both around cost and quality public, and have that really help us both as consumers, as policymakers, make the right choices and do the right things. And I see this bill as really part of what is a large conversation about transparency and the need for transparency within healthcare. The second point I want to make is probably to answer the next question that you would ask, which is, well, why within healthcare? And why is healthcare any different than anything else? Why should healthcare be any different than any other business or any other operation? And I think the answer to that is twofold, that there are those of us who certainly see healthcare as a business, and indeed there is a large part of healthcare which is a business and which operates in a marketplace. One of the largest expenditures of the state is healthcare, both through our Medicaid program and our public employees healthcare benefit program. It's one of the largest expenditures of the federal government through the Medicare program, and indeed it's become a huge expenditure for our businesses in our state. So healthcare is indeed part of this is a business issue. But I think what separates healthcare is that in addition to being a business interest, healthcare is also a public good. And I think it's that balance between both the marketplace and the whole issue of a public good is where the issue of transparency really falls. And so I see this bill as being part of that conversation about transparency, and I think we need to, all of us, look at the mutual ties that bind us, the ties that bind us around healthcare from the provider, physician side, nurses, from hospitals, policymakers, business, industry. We are inextricably linked with a group of ties that bind us both in our business interests and in our interests to do public good. And as part of that, and part of the foundation of that, is indeed a climate of openness and disclosure and of transparency, which I believe helps all of us, whether it is in our business interests, our interests in the public good, and in our trust in one another. It is in that disclosure. And, you know, in closure, I would just say that whenever I go talk at a healthcare meeting these days, I'm actually asked to do the very same thing, which is a disclosure of conflicts of interest, and to indicate what indeed any conflicts that I might have, much as many of the rest of us are. So I believe this is a bill which helps us really advance what we're all looking to do, which is to create an open and competitive marketplace that operates for the public good. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Since you were the last physician speaking, I think, I have a question, and maybe it's not one that you can answer. Do you know what is required, the educational background of the drug representatives? I think we heard the detailer. I assume that's a drug rep, and they're one to every 2.5 physicians in the country. Do you know what their educational background is?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, I do not. I think that's a question others can better answer than myself.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
maybe this is Dr. Garland, and then I'm going to call you doctor. You earned it. And either one of you can answer this. You mentioned the conflict of interest, and it's important that we declare a conflict of interest. And the person, my good representative, Greenlick, was talking about the decision maker is actually the doctor. And it goes back to my point of the doctor declaring the conflict of interest, because he is the one, or she is the one, that is actually the decision maker of where I'm writing this prescription out. I'd like to know where you stand on putting this responsibility on the doctor who is actually making the decision to write the prescription, and from an ethics standpoint.
Madam Chair, Representative Cameron, I believe that disclosure, it should be across all segments of the healthcare industry, whether that be in terms of manufacturers or in terms of physicians. As I had indicated, when I go speak at a meeting, I fill out a very similar form. I think disclosure is important for everybody, and I actually agree with Representative Anderson, who raised this issue about integrity. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to maintain that integrity. I agree with what Ronald Reagan said, which was trust but verify. And I trust in the profession, I trust in all of us, but I believe that the disclosure is really part of the verification.
Thank you.
Just you made me think of that old saying that Cromwell told his soldiers when they were wading across the Boyne River in Ireland, trust in God, but keep your powder dry. I think the issue is right at the heart of what you're saying. Yes, I believe doctors need to have that transparency that Dr. Goldberg is talking about. And I believe we meaning the American people and the people of the state of Oregon, desperately need doctors to get behind the effort to control the costs of health care, and to do so in all of their actions that include prescribing and include engaging their patients on issues about whether we go through along the line of a generic drug prescription or along the line of a more expensive brand name drug, and that the physicians are armed to understand why they may lean one way or the other on that issue. I think it's extremely important.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr.
You're welcome. Thank you. Krista?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Krista Shively. I work for Representative Carolyn Tomei, and we received written testimony from Dr. Martin Donahoe. He was unable to be here, and so I'd like to read it for the committee. The pharmaceutical industry is far and away the most profitable industry in the United States. Americans spend almost $200 billion per year on pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceutical company sales revenue tripled over the last decade, while prices increased 150% compared to 50% increase in the consumer price index. Spending on prescription drug accounts, in part, account for the out-of-control healthcare costs. The United States is the only industrialized country not to regulate prescription drug prices, which helps to explain why drug prices here are 2 to 3 times greater than in other Western democracies. Such costs could be justified if profits were largely reinvested in research on new agents. However, drug companies spend more on advertising and marketing than on research and development. The pharmaceutical industry spends between $12 billion and $15 billion per year on marketing, or $8,000 to $15,000 per physician. A wealth of published peer-reviewed data confirm that such marketing influences physicians' prescribing patterns and is frowned upon by patients. Interactions between physicians and drug company marketing representatives, which are very common, often entail gifts to physicians. Gifts, both large and small, have been shown to influence physicians' willingness to prescribe certain drugs and to make them less likely to prescribe cheaper, equally effective generic medications. voluntary guidelines to limit lavish gifts have been ineffective. Extending their influence over medicine, drug companies also increasingly set research agendas of academic medical centers and provide the majority of financial support for the continuing medical education of physicians in the United States. House Bill 2817 is an important and common sense piece of legislation. Patients should never have to wonder if their doctor's prescriptions were influenced by gifts of food, cash, or travel. Requiring all pharmaceutical manufacturing companies to disclose annually to the Department of Justice the value, nature, and purpose of gifts and other economic subsidies given to healthcare providers and institutions will help restore the credibility of the medical profession and the public's collective trust in medicine in general, and in their physicians' prescribing practices in particular. This bill will uphold the ethical standards that the public has a right to expect from the medical profession. Thank you very much.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate you coming to testify. I think we have one more person signed up to speak, and that is Mary Beth Healy.
I thought maybe I'd back clean up the Dr. Goldberg, but maybe not today. So I have some charts and stuff I would like to hand out as well. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will try to be really brief and not be duplicative in what others have said. My name is Mary Beth Healy, and I am the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security, and we are a coalitional organization of concerned citizens, faith communities, business community, labor community, caregivers, who are really committed and united to advocate for increased access to quality, affordable, and secure health care. Each day we bring to you the Daily Dose, which is a story of an Oregonian and their struggle with our health care system, or lack thereof. And these stories help to illustrate the concerns that Oregonians have in affording quality health care. Prescription drug costs continue to be one of the leading causes of health care increases. 780,000 Oregonians lack access to affordable prescription drugs. Rampant marketing of the latest, greatest, most expensive prescriptions is partly to blame for the skyrocketing costs. And much research looks at the fact that only 22% of these me-too drugs are actually innovative or new. Detailing continues to lead pharmaceutical marketing budgets. According to the trade publication Pharmaceutical Executive, detailing accounts for close to 60% of all marketing expenditures since 1999. And to quote the article, if the second half of 2004 resembles the first, spending on nurse practitioner and physician assistant detailing will have more than doubled since 2000, and hospital detailing has risen 40% since 2002, end quote. And advertising of this industry versus other industries, which I think maybe Representative Anderson or maybe it was Representative Witt, someone asked the question, I'm sorry I don't remember, is also important to look at. Prescription drug companies expenditures on advertising have been increasing at about 14.1% since 1999. That's compared to an average of all other domestic advertising of 3.4%. And then just to make it a little bit worse, the last couple of years have been intensifying. Pharma marketing jumped 18.3% in 2003, and then in the first part of 2004 was increasing at nearly 21%. And I think we all see this anytime we turn on the television, and that's just the direct-to-consumer piece, never mind what goes on to physicians and other healthcare professionals. So these marketing efforts, as we've heard this morning, do influence behavior. In an analysis of several studies, drug company marketing efforts were associated with changing in prescribing patterns. patterns, which I don't think we can quite say enough, and requests to include particular medications on formularies, sometimes counter to existing efficacy evidence, and in a study of residents, medical residents, 84% of these students, or now not students, but residents, thought that their colleagues were influenced by drug company detailing. So when marketing rather than objective and unbiased information shape our physician prescribing patterns, the cost of prescription drugs for consumers, governments, and health insurers will continue to rise faster than the general rate of inflation. And we've kind of heard about these cost containments. And as you all struggle with our budget, this might be just another tool in order to reduce the cost of health care with our state budget. And as many have said, and I will say again, Oregon has been a leader in promoting the use of the most efficacious, cost-effective prescriptions to the Evidence-Based Research Center. HB 2817 represents the next step in the process of informing patients about prescription costs. We believe Oregon patients have a right to know how drug companies are attempting to influence healthcare providers. Ultimately, increased accountability over the drug industry will help to reduce costs. So Oregon should join with Maine and Vermont in requiring pharmaceutical companies to disclose to the state agency their gift-giving activities. And just as state law requires lobbyists to disclose how much they're spending to inform and educate legislators, the drug industry should do the same as they work to inform and educate physicians. So that is the end of my testimony. I'm happy to take questions. And I did, that's it. I would just encourage you to have a work session on this bill as well.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Any questions in the ceiling? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who did not sign up who would like to testify on this bill? Any questions, concerns, colleagues? Thank you all for attending, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2817, and I will close the House Committee on Health and Human Services for April 15th, 2005. Thank you all so much, especially those